So the last time we ended up talking about ions, but I don't remember whether I've talked about bonds in general. Did I give you categories of bonds? Okay. There are different kinds of bonds, some of which are chemical, some of which are non-chemical bonds. That's a fundamental difference to begin with. What I'm about to talk about are chemical bonds, but let me just say what, before I get to the categories of chemical bonds, let me explain what it means for a bond to be a chemical bond. If a chemical bond forms, then you have, because of that chemical bond, new substance. Chemical bonds are bonds that form during chemical reactions. And we've already talked about the fact that any given chemical reaction transforms stuff into other stuff, right? So when a chemical bond forms, there's a rearrangement, but now you have a new substance, a substance that you didn't have before, or at least a new structure. Non-chemical bonds are bonds, and bonds in general are attractive forces between things, but non-chemical bonds aren't nearly as strong as chemical bonds, and they therefore don't hold particles together more or less permanently to form new stuff. All right? That's enough of a distinction right now. We'll talk about non-chemical bonds later. But chemical bonds, even though there are more than two categories of them, and you might learn about all the categories if you take a chemistry course, in this course, we're going to concern ourselves just with two major categories of chemical bonds. And those two categories are ionic bonds, which is what we're starting with in slide 10 once I get to it. But that's one category of chemical bonds, ionic bonds. And the other major category is covalent bonds. Now, probably obvious that the category called ionic bonds has to do with ions. And it does indeed, which is why it's good that we just discussed ions the last time we were here. Slide 10 is an example of the formation of an ionic bond. Well, ionic bonds are named for the fact that ions are involved. And what are the two categories of ions? Right, cations, which are charged which way? What are cations? Positively charged ions, which means what happened in order for that ion to exist? It lost some number of electrons, yes. And what kind of things do that? What kind of elements form cations? Metals, yes, because metals, being on the left side of the periodic table, have outer shells or outer electron levels that are more empty than full. So it's easier for them to lose the small number of electrons that are in that outer shell, in which case you don't even consider that outer shell anymore, and their new outer shell becomes the next lower one, which is already full. Nonmetals, on the other hand, are more full than empty. And so it's easier for them to take on additional electrons to fill their outer shell, and they therefore form what kind of ions? Anions, which are negatively charged because they're taking on those additional negatives. Okay, so there are fundamentally two different kinds of ions just based on the charge, right? Positively charged and negatively charged. And unlike charges, are attractive to each other. Particles that are charged oppositely from each other attract each other. And that's the basis of an ionic bond. Okay? But before that actually happens, the reason that there are ions formed in this process is because of the stability that's gained by either gaining or losing electrons, depending on whether you're a metal or a nonmetal. Okay, here we're using the same example we started with for a chemical reaction, the one that was on slide one. a sodium atom at first and a chlorine atom at first. Both of them are dissatisfied to some extent compared to the right edge noble gases. Which one's the metal? Sodium is a metal. Notice it's on the left edge. It's on the left edge because it has only one electron in its outer shell, which it had to put in that shell because the lower shell wouldn't fit it, right? So that's typical for metals. More empty than full in their outer shell. Well, you could add 7 more electrons to that shell to make it happy, but that's a hell of a lot more difficult than just taking away this one that it has, and therefore now its outer shell is this already filled level 2. So a metal, the sodium ion, wants to get rid of an electron. And if there's a chlorine there as well, it will gladly take the electron on because it is just one step away from the right edge, meaning that it only requires one more electron to fill its almost full outer shell. And therefore, the single transfer of one electron in this case from the metal to the non-metal is simultaneously going to turn both of these atoms into an ion, and simultaneously is going to make each of them very stable because it's going to give them a filled outer shell. That's why the transfer of electrons happens. Okay? It's not that these things are trying to bind. They're simply trying to become stable, and transferring the electron from the metal to the non-metal accomplishes that stability. Once, though, you have two ions that are oppositely charged, they are going to attract each other electrostatically. That's what oppositely charged particles do. So it's that electrostatic attraction between oppositely charged ions, one an anion and one a cation, that holds the two together. That is the basis for the bond itself. And it holds them together strongly enough that you no longer have sodium, you no longer have chlorine, each of which by itself is an element. Now you have a compound, sodium chloride. It's a change in stuff. That's why it's a chemical bond. Okay? Now, I just said this is a strong enough bond to be a chemical bond, which is true. But in the categories that I've given you of chemical bonds, ionic bonds are the weakest. They're stronger than non-chemical bonds, but ionic bonds aren't nearly as strong as the other category, which are covalent bonds. More about covalent bonds, though, once we get to a picture about them. First, though, in slide 11, we're looking at a chunk of salt in the photograph. And you might have thought, or you might think right now, that there is such a thing as a molecule of salt. But that's actually incorrect. Because the word molecule in chemistry should be applied only to substances that involve covalent bonds, which we haven't talked about yet. Okay? Only covalently bonded substances occur in what are called molecules. And molecules, as we'll see, are a definite size. Salts do not have definitely sized particles. Before I forget, by the way, because I really should have said this in the previous slide, we just saw one example of an ionic bond, but the same thing can happen in all kinds of instances. In general, an ionic bond forms between a metal and a non-metal, because that's how you're going to get, if there is ionization, transfer of electrons, that's how you're going to get oppositely charged particles, right? If they're two metals, they're both going to form ions making them positive. They're not going to attract each other. They're going to repel each other. Similarly, if it's two nonmetals forming ions. So, in general, ionic bonds form between a metal and a nonmetal. They will be oppositely charged and stick together. But the point of this slide, which has to do with this molecule word, in slide 11 is that when we just looked at one individual sodium atom becoming an ion and one individual chlorine becoming an ion. That's possibility, but in reality, there's quadrillions and quadrillions of both sodiums and chlorines, right? Even in a tiny sample, there's that many. Well, when the transfer of electrons occurs from one metal atom to one non-metal atom, the ions are formed. But once you have a negatively charged chloride ion, it is not negative in just one direction. It's negative appearing, so to speak, all around itself. And so if there's a positively charged ion, it will be attracted to that chloride ion in all directions. Similarly, but oppositely, for a sodium, it's not positive in just one direction. So if you have many of each of these two ions, they will form a crystal like this, because each of the positively charged yellow ones is attracting multiple green negatively charged chlorides on all sides of it. You see what I'm saying there? And so the one single piece of salt can be as big as you want to make it, as long as you have enough ions. And when salt, sodium chloride, is mined so that it can be sold as table salt, you can have chunks that are bigger than this building, a single chunk. That's not how molecules work. Molecules are in predefined, so to speak, definite sizes. Salts aren't. And the word salt, by the way, is just another name for an ionic compound. This brings up a separate point. As I was just saying about bond formation, ionic bonds form between a metal and a non-metal. Therefore, if you have such a bond, obviously the result is going to be a compound, right? Because you have two different elements, one a metal and one a non-metal. You can't have an ionic bond between two of the same element because they won't be attracted to each other. So when you have ionic bonds, you have a compound. They're called ionic compounds. That's one name you can call them. But just a one-word name that means the same thing is salt. And that's why I said when we started this chapter that what we call salt is really just one of many, many different salts. There are many different possible ionic compounds. So there is no maximum to the size of a salt, but there is a minimum, of course. In the case of sodium chloride, the bare minimum is what we looked at in the previous slide. You have to have at least one sodium ion and one chloride ion, otherwise you don't have sodium chloride. So no maximum, but there is a minimum, and that minimum piece of a salt is not called a molecule, it's called a formula unit. All right, now let's go to 12 and talk about the other category. Go ahead, you don't have to raise your hand, just yell. The smallest possible piece of a given salt. Now, some salts form with two of one ion, two metals and one non-metal, for instance. They would have a different chemical formula. That's why it's called a formula unit. In 12, we're now starting to investigate the other major category of chemical bonds, which are covalent, as I've said. And if you look at the word, just like ionic made sense in terms of words, so does covalent. Co as a prefix means share. And valent has to do with valence. Now, the reason I have to ask whether I've talked about things is because I have two sections and you're in two different places in my progress. So did I talk about valence at all yet? Okay, well then I have to start there before we can even talk about covalent bonding. All right, I have to pause here because and take care of this first because this is potentially confusing. There is a word, valence, in chemistry, But that one word can be used three different ways. This is why it's potentially confusing. All right? One use of the word is in the phrase valence electrons. The phrase valence electrons refers to any electrons that are in whatever atom you're concerned with's outer shell. So any given atom, of course, has a certain number of electrons. But not all, necessarily, of those electrons are valence electrons. For hydrogen, it only has one electron, right? So all of its electrons, its only electron, is its valence electron. But sodium, which we were just looking at, has 11 total electrons. Only one of those is a valence electron, though, because the other 10 are in levels 2 and 1, which are not in the outer shell. So that's one use of the word valence in the phrase valence electrons. And therefore, we can talk about an atom's number of valence electrons, right? For hydrogen, it's 1. For lithium, it's 1. For sodium, it's 1. Notice they're in the same group. All right, another use of that same word is in the phrase valence shell. An atom's valence shell is simply the outermost shell that has at least one electron in it. Or in other words, the shell that contains the valence electrons. Same thing. Shells exist whether they're filled or not. But it's a valence shell only if it's the outermost shell that has at least one electron in it. Which would be shell 3 for sodium. Notice it's in period 3. It would be shell 2 for lithium and so on. Okay, the other use of the word, valence, is just by itself, the word valence. So each, and this use of the word is primarily reserved for speaking about nonmetals, the ones in the upper right-hand corner except for the noble gases, right? Carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, those are nonmetals. And a nonmetal's valence is the number of additional electrons you would have to supply it with to fill that atom's valence shell. Okay, so the valence is not the same as the number of valence electrons. It's not necessarily the same. It can coincidentally be the same, and it is, for instance, for hydrogen. Hydrogen has one valence electron, right? But 2 is the magic number for the first level. 2 completely fills the level. So in the case of hydrogen, the valence is also 1 simply because 2 minus 1 means you have to supply it with an additional 1 to fill it. All right? But for period 2, 8 is the magic number. And fluorine has 7 valence electrons, has 9 total electrons, but 7 valence electrons. Everyone follow me on that? And the valence shell, which is shell 2, can hold 8, so it's just 1 away from being filled. Therefore, its valence is 1. In general, the valence is how many more you have to give it to satisfy its shell, to fill that outer shell. Practically speaking, you can also think of the valence as how many steps away from the right edge one of these nonmetals is. Fluorine's 1 step away from being stable. Its valence is 1. Oxygen's is 2 because it has 6 valence electrons. You have to add 2 to 6 to get to 8.
Are covalent bonds an interaction with 2 nonmetals?
Yes. Yeah, and I'll say that explicitly, but that's a good reasoning. Okay, everyone understand all three uses of these words? Well, the valence of a nonmetal is really the number of additional electrons that's going to satisfy it, make it stable, right? But practically, it's also going to indicate the number of covalent bonds that it's going to have to make in order to be satisfied. Now, that definition uses covalent bonds, which I still haven't really defined, so that'll make more sense in a minute. But covalent literally means sharing valence electrons. That's not what happened with the ionic bond we just looked at. In an ionic bond, there is a transfer, more or less permanent transfer, from one metallic atom to one non-metallic atom, forming two ions that are therefore electrostatically attracted to each other. That's not a sharing, that's a transfer. For a covalent bond, there is a sharing of some number of pairs of electrons. It's important to the word pair there is important. The smallest possible covalent bond is a single covalent bond, but one single covalent bond is made up of one pair, two overall electrons. And that's because in order for this to be sharing, both of the participants have to be contributing an electron. All right? Let's look at the hydrogen example to make a sense of this. Each of these two hydrogen atoms, before they meet, is dissatisfied. They want to be like helium, right? The right edge in that same period. That means they want to take on an additional electron to fill the shell one. Well, if there's a transfer of electrons, that will satisfy one hydrogen. It would gladly take the electron, right? But the other hydrogen is not going to stand for that. It's going to make it even less stable. So more or less, each of these two hydrogen atoms is making a deal with the other. Each one is saying, I will share my one electron with you if you promise to share your one electron with me. When they do that, even though the electrons are not going to be the sole property of either of the two nuclei, the fact that they're being shared means that each of the two nuclei gets credit for both of them. There's only two overall electrons, but each atom can claim them, at least partially, for themselves. And that's what makes them both stable. And notice, though, that that's an electron from each of the two atoms. That's why what's shared, in the simplest case of covalence, is a pair of electrons. One pair of electrons forms a single covalent bond. That's what we see on the bottom here. The clouds have merged in the figure to illustrate that, because we still don't know exactly where the electrons are. Now, what makes this sharing, though, is that the electrons, the two in the pair, that are shared by these two atoms, are spending at least some time around each of the two atomic nuclei. In larger atoms, where not every electron is involved in sharing, there will be some shared electrons and some unshared electrons. Unshared electrons stay with the atom they started with, and they're there full time. The shared electrons, you know, like I said, we don't know where they are. They don't follow a definite path, but you can think of it as forming a figure eight here. They're spending some time around each of these. That's why both of them get credit for both electrons. And that's what holds them together. That's what holds the two hydrogen atoms together. And it not only holds them together, it holds them together much more tightly than the electrostatic attraction in an ionic bond holds a metal and a nonmetal. And what you correctly predicted is that this sharing happens between two nonmetals, whereas an ionic bond forms between a metal and a nonmetal. A covalent bond forms between a nonmetal and a nonmetal. Well, there's Notice that there's more than one nonmetal, right? There's very few of them compared to the metals, but there's several. And that means there's two ways this could happen. You could have a covalent bond between two of the same nonmetal. That's what we have here. Two hydrogens are the same element, right? And therefore, what's forming here is not a compound. Not all covalent substances are compounds. This is an element still. It's pure hydrogen, but now it's in molecule form rather than atomic form. On the other hand, though, you could also form a nonmetal, covalent bond between a nonmetal and some other nonmetal, in which case it would be a compound. So there are covalent compounds and there are covalent elements, depending on how many kinds of elements are involved. But in the case of molecules in general, which are covalent structures, it's nonmetals, not metals, that are involved. You might think that there's not all that many possibilities since there are relatively so few nonmetals. But there is a hell of a lot of mathematically possible ways in which this relatively small number of nonmetals can be put together, especially when you don't have to involve just two. There are very large molecules, namely the macromolecules I talked about, that all organisms have, those four major categories. Those all involve nonmetals, but a lot of them covalently bonded. And in any size molecule, not this simplest, this is the simplest molecule really, because it's only two of the smallest nonmetal. No matter how complex the molecule, though, is, each of the participating atoms is satisfying its own valence. And that's what I meant earlier when I said the valence, I think I said this earlier, the valence you can think of as how many bonds that kind of element needs to make. Oxygen, if it's part of a molecule, is always going to have to be making two bonds. Hydrogen has to make one whenever it's involved. All right. Now, speaking of two bonds, there's two ways that that can happen. In slide 13, we see what we just looked at on the left, but in different format. This is using what are called electron dot diagrams to show the formation of a hydrogen molecule out of two hydrogen atoms. Let me just quickly explain what the electron dot diagram is. It's just a shorthand notation in which you start with the symbol, the periodic table symbol for the element, in this case H, that represents the nucleus. Instead of drawing a proton or a neutron or some number of each of those, you just write down the chemical formula. Now, importantly, in an electron dot diagram, only valence electrons are depicted because those are the ones that matter. You know, when you think about two atoms encountering each other, which has to happen for there to be a chemical reaction, right? It's not the nuclei that come into contact. And it's also not all of the electrons that come into contact. What actually come into contact are the valence electrons of each of the two atoms. Those are the ones that get rearranged in chemistry, in chemical reactions. Okay? And so those are the ones that we care about. Those are the only ones that we care about when we draw these diagrams. Well, for hydrogen, there's only one total electron. So we are drawing a dot for each of them, and there's only one. Doesn't matter what side you put it on. You put it there, though. The other hydrogen has the same electron dot diagram, but what do we call the spaces, the smallest spaces in which you find electrons?
Orbitals,
exactly. Well, that first shell, which is the valence shell for hydrogen, has only one orbital, because the orbital is really the same thing as the subshell, which is really the same thing as the overall shell. Let's do oxygen, though. Oxygen has a total, as you can see, of 8 electrons, but only 6 of those are valence electrons, and therefore we have only 6 dots to put down, because we just ignore those lower level ones. They're shielded by the valence electrons, so they're not going to be involved in chemical reactions. But you start with the nucleus. Now you have 6 electrons you have to list here as dots. But which shell are we in for oxygen? Right, but specifically for oxygen, which shell is that? Shell 2, exactly. And how many orbitals are in shell 2? No? 4. There's a 2P, I mean there's a 2S, and there are 3 different 2Ps, for a total of 4 orbitals. So think of the orbitals as just being on each 4 corners of this O. Not because that's really how they are in space, but just because it's easy to draw on 4 sides. The reason I'm mentioning this is because when you put dots down, and you have to put dots down until you run out of valence electrons, you don't ever pair them up to fill an orbital until you have to. So start by putting each electron in its own orbital until you run out of orbitals, which in the case of oxygen you run out of in 4, because there's 4 overall orbitals in that shell. You following that? You have 2 more because there are 6 total valence electrons, so then you have to pair up 2 of them. It doesn't matter which 2. Well, these full orbitals, those are going to stay the property of oxygen. It's unfilled, unsatisfied orbitals that are the ones that make the overall atom unstable and makes it want to engage in covalent bonding to satisfy that valence. So another oxygen has the same condition, right? It's these unpaired orbitals that are going to be involved in the sharing. So these 2 are shared, and these 2 are shared for a total of 2 pairs, or 4 electrons. And that forms what's called a double covalent bond, which is even stronger than a single covalent bond. All right? Well, that's one way that oxygen can satisfy its valence. Its valence is 2. It has to make 2 overall bonds. A double covalent bond counts as 2. But it can also make 2 single covalent bonds with 2 separate other partners. That also adds up to 2. The point is, any molecule that oxygen is part of, each oxygen is forming 2 bonds total. There is even such a thing as a triple covalent bond, which is the strongest of all 3. And you have that in the case of nitrogen. Look at nitrogen very quickly to understand this. It has a valence of what? What is nitrogen's valence? What did I say is the practical way to think about it when you're looking at the periodic table? No? Why 3? What's the practical way of thinking about it? It's 3 steps from the edge, right? Now, mathematically, the reason it's 3 is because it has 7 total electrons, right? 2 of which are in the first shell. That leaves 5 valence electrons. But in that second shell, 8 is the goal, and therefore the valence is 8 minus 5, 3 you have to add. The valence is 3. Everyone understand that? So when you individually draw electron dot diagrams for nitrogen, you use 4 of those 5 to half-fill each of the 4 orbitals, and then you pair up 1 of them. So the other one's going to be in the same situation. It has 3 unsatisfied orbitals. Therefore, it's going to share this pair, and this pair, to form what's called a triple covalent bond, the strongest chemical bond. And this has actual biological implications. All organisms absolutely require nitrogen to exist, because nitrogen is in both protein. Every protein has nitrogen, every polypeptide, which is one of the four major macromolecule categories, and every nucleic acid, DNA and RNA, every little individual piece of the DNA contains nitrogen. You can't have organisms without it. We are terrestrial organisms, so the fluid that we live in is the air, as opposed to water. And ironically, about 3/4 of that mixture we call air is pure nitrogen. But neither we nor almost any other organism can use that rich source of nitrogen directly, even though we die without nitrogen. And this is just one of several reasons why we cannot live without bacteria. There's only a few species of bacteria that are able to break this extraordinarily tight bond from pure nitrogen gas, N2, and incorporate those nitrogen atoms into usable form for the rest of the world. So it's a strong bond. It's a covalent bond, though. All right, now, in 14, we're just looking at different ways of portraying these bonds. We can draw overlaps of these shells that we've looked at before. That's nice that it reminds you exactly how many total electrons are involved. Remember, it's always one pair for each single bond. You can use these dot diagrams, but then for shorthand, as I've done over here for nitrogen, instead of drawing a shared pair of dots, you can just draw one dash. One dash is two electrons, one from each of the two participants. And that kind of is easier to look at as a bond. But just remember that one bar is two electrons, two is four, and three bars is six total electrons that are shared. And then the space-filling models are nice, that we can do those with computers, but they don't give you really all that much information. Notice what I said earlier about oxygen is true. Oxygen is involved in water. That's a molecule because it's a covalent structure. Well, oxygen is making two total bonds, but in this case it's making two single bonds rather than making one double bond. They both add up to two. And hydrogen's always going to be making one because its valence is one. All right, let's take a closer look at water in slide 15. This is what was a single water molecule, or a model of it. And so this brings up the fact that while covalent is one of the two major categories of chemical bonds we're looking at in this course, we're going to subdivide that category, covalent, into subcategories. In other words, there are multiple different kinds of covalent bonds. And those two major kinds of covalent bonds are called nonpolar covalent bonds and, as you might have guessed, polar covalent bonds. Okay, so there aren't any really subdivisions of ionic, just covalent. Well, you've already learned that to be a covalent bond, there has to be a sharing of electrons, some number of pairs of electrons. But you might have already noticed from life that you can have a sharing situation that actually isn't all that fair, right? Just because there is sharing doesn't mean there's equal sharing. And that's the distinction between the two subcategories of covalent bonds. A nonpolar covalent bond is one in which the shared pairs of electrons, however many pairs there are shared, are equally shared between the two participating atoms. What I mean by that is that the shared electrons are spending the same amount of time around each of those two atomic nuclei. They're not being hogged by one of the participants or the other. But that's not the case for polar covalent bonds. In a polar covalent bond, of course, there is sharing, because it wouldn't be covalent without sharing. But one of the two participants is hogging the shared pair, or however many pairs. Meaning that that shared pair of electrons is spending more time around one of the two nuclei than it is around the other nucleus. All right? Now, yeah, go ahead.
What's the little S plus and S minus? Is that just like what type of positive or negative?
I'll get there, but it's also a D. It's a delta, not an S. But I'm heading there. I just want to get through some things first. So based on what I just said, a naturally occurring question might have popped up in your head already is, why would there be unequal sharing? Well, this has to do with a property that any element has. So every one of the elements on the periodic table has a value for this property. But the property is called electronegativity. And roughly speaking, an atom's electronegativity value is an indication of how greedy it is for electrons, so to speak. In other words, it's a numerical indication of how attractive an atom is for electrons. Like I said, every element has a value. Now, there's a trend that's not perfect. There are some exceptions to it. But if we exclude the noble gases, which do not have high electronegativities because they're all satisfied, they don't want any more, right? If you exclude that right edge, though, and think of the rest of the table, the elements at the lower left have low values for electronegativity, and they get bigger as you go up to the upper right, except for the noble gases. So which of the elements, based on that, has the highest electronegativity? Based on what I said. No one has any guess based on what I just said. Low at the bottom left and goes up at the top right. That's a noble gas. I said to exclude the right edge. Yes, fluorine has the highest value for electronegativity, meaning it really wants electrons for itself. That's what I meant by greediness. Well, oxygen's right next door. It's not quite as high as fluorine, but almost. So it's among the highest values of electronegativity found among the elements, oxygen. Hydrogen, much lower value. And oxygen and hydrogen are the two types of elements in a water molecule. Now, oxygen's valence is 2, so it has to make 2 overall bonds, as we've said. But in this case, it's making 2 separate single covalent bonds, each with 1 of 2 hydrogens. Right? So the same thing is going on for both of these bonds, but let's just consider one of the bonds. Oxygen sharing one of its electrons with that hydrogen. Hydrogen is sharing its only electron with oxygen. And therefore, there's a pair that's shared. But because the value for electronegativity of oxygen is much higher than the value for electronegativity of hydrogen, that means there's unequal sharing, and the electrons spend more than half of the time around the oxygen end of the bond than they do around the hydrogen end of the bond. Well, this now can explain why this is called a polar covalent bond. Polar, in general, refers to two ends that are different in some way. In this case, the two ends are the ends of the bond, so the atomic nuclei are really the poles. But what's different about them is charge. And that's because if the electrons spend more time around the oxygen than the hydrogen, that's going to make the oxygen end of that bond slightly negative, because electrons themselves are negative. Where you find the electrical the negative charge more often is at the oxygen end. And that's exactly what the lowercase delta, if it were uppercase, it would be the equilateral triangle. But Greek D is delta, and that's the lowercase version. And so delta minus means slightly negative. It's not a full charge like a negative ion would have, because the electron is not there all the time. If it were there all the time, it would be a full negative charge. It's there more often than not, but not always. And the end of the the end of the bond that where the electrons, shared electrons, are found not as often, the hydrogen end, is therefore going to be slightly positive. Delta plus. That is the essence of a polar covalent bond. Because of the unequal sharing, not only is there unequal sharing, but there is a partial charge separation at the ends. And that, it's impossible to overstate the importance of that. We would not exist, and no other organisms would exist, if that weren't true. Water is an example of a polar molecule, polar covalent structures are made up of polar covalent bonds. And water has two of them. So it's a polar compound. All right. Now, speaking of compounds, they have to be made up of of different kinds of elements to be compounds, right? Imagine two oxygens as atoms individually encountering each other, just like the two hydrogens that we looked at before, except that oxygen has a much higher electronegativity value. So each oxygen wants to hog both electrons if the two get together, because they're much more greedy than hydrogen. But each of these two identical oxygens is just as greedy as the other. So neither one wins out. In that case, since they're the same element, the sharing is equal. And so an oxygen molecule made of two oxygen atoms covalently bonded with a double bond is a nonpolar molecule. Well, if you have trillions and trillions of nonpolar molecules, like oxygen, in a box container, first of all, notice that they're a definite size, like all molecules. They don't grow indefinitely like the crystals of salts. Each one is made up, for oxygen, is made up of exactly two atoms. And so each molecule is two oxygen atoms, but that's a complete thing, that one molecule. And you have trillions of others, but because they don't have any charge, since they're nonpolar molecules, they just bounce off of each other. They don't feel any attraction for each other. But that's not true for nonpolar molecules, including water. You know, if you have trillions of water molecules, each molecule is its own thing, once again. But when a water molecule comes up against another water molecule, there can be a slight attractive force, because there's part of the water molecule that's partially positive and part that's partially negative. Actually, we see that in slide 16, except it's using one water molecule and one ammonia molecule on the bottom. Both of these are polar molecules, and doesn't matter whether you have two of the same, like two waters or two ammonias, or two different. Well, it's really not two anyway. It's going to be trillions and trillions in a sample. The point is, when you have polar molecules, they don't simply bounce off of each other when they get close enough to each other, they will start to swivel. Kind of like when you get two magnets close together without actually touching them. You can feel that they're trying to arrange themselves in a certain way. These polar molecules swivel in such a way that the partially positive end of one is going to face the partially negative end of the next one, because opposites attract, just like in an ionic bond. This is not nearly as strong as an ionic bond, which is why this is not going to make a bigger molecule. It's not a chemical bond. They're going to remain as individual molecules, in this case water and ammonia. But they will have a slight attractive force between them, and that's going to make things, properties different about that population of molecules compared to a population of nonpolar molecules, including a bunch of properties that allowed for life to come into existence on the planet. And we call this slight attraction between polar molecules hydrogen bonds, not because hydrogen necessarily has to be involved. It just often is because there are so many hydrogens. Okay, we call it a hydrogen bond whether hydrogen's involved or not. That's just depicted here by these five dots. That is not a chemical bond, though. This is a much weaker bond than an ionic bond, and it doesn't make new stuff. That's true in general of non-chemical bonds. 17. Here we're looking at the consequence an explanation of why molecules have the shapes they do. You're just using a couple examples. Water, for instance, you already knew coming into this class probably that it was H2O, meaning there's two hydrogens and one oxygen involved in the molecule. But you might be wondering, wouldn't it be more symmetrical and therefore more likely if the oxygen's in the middle and the hydrogens are on opposite ends? Well, that's a good question. But the reason that it doesn't happen is because of what's depicted here on the right edge of the water row. Oxygen, remember, think back to the electron dot diagram of oxygen. It has four overall orbitals, valence orbitals, right? Orbitals in the valence shell. And orbitals in general contain electrons, all of which are negative. Well, like charges repel each other, they don't attract. So if you have four orbitals, all of which are negatively charged because they contain electrons, and they're trying to get away from each other, in space, the way that you can maximize the distance between those four is for those four orbitals to form the four corners of a tetrahedron, which to you gaming nerds is the four-sided die, like a triangular pyramid. So the oxygen is inside that die, the solid of that die, and the four points of it are the four orbitals of oxygen in that shell. But two of these corners are non-shared electrons. All right, they're still there, we just don't depict them in this space-filling model. The other two corners, the unpaired orbitals, are the ones involving bonds with hydrogen. And so the angle between those two is exactly the angle you predict between the corners of a tetrahedron. That's why it exists that way. If you look at methane, the simplest hydrocarbon, we'll discuss these later, its carbon has a valence of four. Notice it's four steps away from the right edge. So it has to be making four overall bonds, which it is by making four individual single covalent bonds with four different hydrogens. So that all the hydrogens are on the corners. Kind of a shift in gears. In this slide, I want to talk a little bit about chemical signals. Not all signals are chemical signals, but right now I'm going to talk about chemical signals. A chemical signal is simply a signal that is a chemical, but a signal is something that causes something to happen in a cell that wouldn't happen if the signal weren't present. All right? This is how the nervous system and the endocrine system work, via signals. All right? So signals cause things to happen. And a chemical signal is simply a particle, usually a molecule, but some sort of particle, some chemical, that will not... Well, before I even get to that, a chemical signal is our first example of several in this course of something that's called a ligand. Ligand gets its name because the L-I-G part of it means tie, like in ligature. Or to ligate means to tie together. A ligand is something, and it's a real general term, something that binds to something else. A chemical signal is just one of many examples of a ligand. We'll look at other examples later. But specifically, the thing that the chemical signal, which is the ligand here, binds to is a kind of protein specializing as a signal receptor. These purple blobs in the bottom figure, each of those is a receptor. Now, this brings up an important point about chemical signals. No chemical signal will have any effect or won't cause anything unless and until that chemical signal binds to a receptor that has the right shape to receive it. This is why you can broadcast a hormone, which is an example of a chemical signal, all over the body. Like I was saying, for positive feedback, remember I used parturition as the example? Well, the whole body gets that oxytocin signal, but most of the body just doesn't have the receptors to bind to it, so it doesn't even realize the oxytocin's there.
And
what makes what a good candidate?
Is there certain factors that it has to
have? Yeah, it depends on what's happening in the body, okay. As to, you know, what is the necessary thing that needs to occur for homeostasis, basically.
Okay.
So there's all kinds of signals that cause all kinds of effects, but no chemical signal will do anything unless the cell has not only a receptor, but the right shaped receptor to fit, kind of like a glove and a hand or a lock and a key, the molecule that is the signal itself. So on the left we have natural endorphin. This is not only a chemical signal, it's an example of an endogenous signal. Now the gen, as in generate or genesis, means create. Endo means within. So endogenous means created within the organism. We make our own endorphin. And it acts as a signal. It's a hormone. Notice you see it binding here to a receptor in a brain cell. By the way, this is something else that's important in general about ligands, not just as chemical signals. But any ligand, when it does bind, it's typically it's a protein of some sort that it binds to, but ligand by definition binds to something. When that occurs, when there is a binding of a ligand to a protein, there is a change in shape of the protein. And that's really how the cell realizes that the signal is there. The change in shape causes something else to happen, and so on down the line until you have the ultimate result. All right, so endorphin is an endogenous signal. To its right, we see morphine, which is exogenous. We don't make morphine in our body. Exogenous means created outside. So we have to introduce that into the body for it to act as a signal. And a simpler name for an exogenous signal is drug. That's what a drug is. A signal molecule that we don't make on our own. But the important point that's made on the bottom here is that although endorphin is a much more complex molecule overall compared to morphine, it's made up of a lot more atoms and it's bigger, the important or business end of the endorphin molecule is just the part that's in the black inset, because that's the part that fits perfectly into a complementary shape on the protein that's acting as the receptor. This is the key that fits into the lock. All right? Well, even though morphine isn't really all like very much like endorphin overall, it has this part that is similar enough to the key part of endorphin that it will also fit into those receptors. And therefore, it will cause the same effect as natural endorphin does. We'll talk about signals again later, but that is the end of that chapter. Whoops.